Hello and welcome to Carnegie Conversations, where we'll be exploring the science of performance. I'm Tanya Arnold, and we're here at the Carnegie School of Sport at Leeds Beckett University, where there's some incredible work going on to help elite athletes, coaches, and governing bodies. On these podcasts, we'll be talking about different areas of what they do. Well, this episode is very much about the area that we're sitting in because we're going to be focusing on strength and conditioning with two-time world featherweight champion Josh Warrington, Andrew Langford, a former Leeds Beckett student, now an S&C coach, and Dr. Alex Dinsdale, who is senior lecturer in sport and exercise biomechanics here. Josh, as we sit here and speak, you're in training to take on Lee Wood. You've had a session already this morning. Mm-hmm. How did it go? And are you and your strength and conditioning coach still talking to each other?
We are. It's been a good session. Finishing the back end of the week. Fridays are always a tough days because the weekends is my rest period. I walked in today, repeat myself as per usual. I'm tired today, Andrew. I'm tired today, but we end up having some good numbers and performed well today. So I'm happy where we are. Just over 11 weeks away in a very good place.
I'm guessing Josh is pretty good to work with, having known him for a fair few years. I know he's pretty disciplined and driven.
You know, people often ask me about different athletes I've worked with and things like that. And I think Josh is definitely one of those who, from a work ethic perspective, it's pretty much unmatched. You get those rare few athletes with each team who really dedicated, really want to do it. A lot of the time within teams, you have the majority who just get on with it, and then you have a few who don't really care. I think Josh is really one of those athletes who buys into it, wants to train as hard as possible, one that you almost have to pull back a little bit at times because he wants to keep pushing, keep improving, keep doing more, which is great, to be honest. You can't complain with that. But yeah, he's fantastic to work with.
How has your view or how has the attitude, how has the importance of strength and conditioning changed over your boxing career?
Well, I think throughout the years, Tanya, it's me and my team, we never stop learning. People have come and gone from Team Leeds Warrior, but my old man's been the central basis of it, and he's learned, as have I. When you look back to things that we first used to do, back when I made my debut in 2009, it's some stuff like scary. Even going to my first titles, the first direct, British titles, English titles, it's nothing compared to what we do now. And as you get older as well, and fights become different, tactics change, you've got to change things that go alongside that. But I think it got to a stage of when I was around 2013. I just won my first title, but compared to the rest of the fighters in the division, I'm probably lacking in some areas. Me and my old fellow went and had a chat with Kerry Kays, who used to be the man behind CMP, and he worked quite famously, worked with Ricky Hatton, made Ricky Hatton into the super fit man that he was, and it gave him that explosiveness in the body shots. He was the man behind his nutrition as well. So we had a fair bit of talking about nutrition. I think we had to make a weight in a short space of time. So he gives us some best advice. And then I followed up on that because I was massively intrigued. I was a massive fan of Rick as well, asking questions and stuff. And, we just started to adapt S&C into our training. And it didn't seem that long ago, but we are, talking 12 years ago. And how it's come on and developed over 12 years, it's crazy. I mean, over the last 5 years, you can look on social media and everyone's a personal trainer or can give you tips of what to do. I mean, I've seen pages where this is what you'd want to do if you're a boxer and this is how you get to the top. And I'm like, you look at it and you laugh to yourself. The team's always asked for advice of people who've been there and done it and people who are in the know. And again, we've adapted. It's just constant. It's a constant learning process, really. Certain styles, my old man will speak with Andrew and say, right, I want him to be like this. So Andrew can tailor the training around certain camps.
We will get to that because that is an area I want to explore. Alex, is this shift that we've seen, that strength and conditioning has become something that you used to have a fitness coach. Strength and conditioning is almost a relatively new phrase.
Yeah, relatively new in a way that slightly before I started. So I started about 2003 was when I got into S&C. Yeah, back in those days, strength and conditioning wasn't kind of a well-known, well-established title. And it's kind of moved definitely in over the last like 15 years, and now we've got some kind of S&C supporting most major programs of their kind of physical development. And then through that period, how we integrate with other people, so working with a physiotherapist, working with a sports science support team, is definitely something that's come on in the last kind of 15, 10 years, where most programs now have that kind of integrated approach to help support your athletes. So we don't want them to break down, do we? We want them to kind of keep getting better, but not getting injured anymore.
Is the conditioning part of strength and conditioning almost become more important?
It very much depends on the athlete. I think, you know, you could take the term strength and conditioning and then think that's all it means, strength and conditioning, but really it encompasses everything else as well. So you've got agility in there, you've got flexibility, you've got speed. There's all those different components of fitness. And I think as an S&C coach working with a team or an athlete, you're trying to figure out how to strategize a plan where you get all of those aspects ticked off and improve them all. Conditioning is certainly a huge part of that. Probably the biggest challenge as an S&C coach is often a lot of conditioning aspects are met or done as well as part of their team training or the sport training. So you have to try and get that balance with, well, how can we implement some of that as well within what we do that's not taken away from what they're doing as well or complementing what they do. That's the challenging balance as an S&C coach, to figure out which aspects of those fitness we can enhance and work on and develop alongside arguably the more important aspect, which is them actually playing their sport.
I remember a few years back filming with you and your stable mate Maxie Hughes being put through the most brutal circuit training I have ever witnessed. I mean, watching it, I was in pain, let alone what it was like for you and Maxie doing it, being put through by your dad. Do you still do that? Is that still part of the routine? And is that, you know, that big conversations need to be had of we're doing that on that day and so you can't do this and that and the other day?
Yeah, definitely. It's something we still do. It's the ad nitty-gritty. You know, the sport boxing is very tough, and I'm known throughout the business of having an engine. Josh Robinson's got this engine, but it all comes down to what we do in the gymnasium. And again, things have maybe changed. You know, might not do that specific one now. You know, a few more exercises might have been added and taken away. When we started doing our S&C, it was still relatively new, and still you had some coaches where that the old school mentality where you need to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning, you need to go run 10 miles. We fight for 36 minutes, that's a maximum in a 12-round fight. Why do you need to go running for over an hour? You know, so everything that we do is more or less tailored to our sport. Like I'm known, like I say, I'm having a busy engine. That's because I fight ferocious. I'm on the front foot. I try to set the pace. Maxie, he's a go-forward counter-puncher, so he's waiting for that attack, bam. And elements of the S&C, you know, tailor into how the game plan will go for the fight.
So how much do you work with the rest of Josh's team? Are you part of tailoring those circuits so that you actually go, actually, that one's not good for him?
Yeah, we certainly look to bits like that. I think for me, I want to be quite mindful that you don't overstep the mark, because there is that respect as well, where I know that athletes like Josh, his dad, who've been involved in the sport, will have learned from experience of what works for them as well. So it can't always be just me saying, oh, this isn't in the textbook, you can't do it. You know, you kind of have to look at it rationally and analyze it. And you can obviously give suggestions on that. And there has been some times over the years where I've said, maybe you don't need to do that as much because we're doing this bits as well and other bits. So you do get that tailoring. But then equally, I've learned things from them. And there's probably things that haven't been proven yet in the research, or things that world champions and high-level athletes are doing that hasn't yet been understood why it works. So there is that bit of that integration as well going on. But yeah, from my perspective, I think you have to work really closely with the athlete, with the coach, understand what they're doing in their training, and then figure that out with what we're going to do in our training. Because, you know, if he comes in on a Friday and he's just done a huge circuit the night before, we're obviously not going to be able to do the power speed type exercises we want to do because he's too fatigued. So, you know, you have to figure out that balance. And we're at a point now where we know you know, how is training structured, that we can do certain things when he comes in with us that are going to complement then what he's doing in his other training sessions and everything else. So we've got that balance, we think, pretty good.
Alex, it must be quite exciting, you know, just listening to Andrew, of the constant learning process of learning off each other.
It's a really interesting thing, especially within the field of strength and conditioning, where you're building your program together to help your athlete achieve, you know, their goals, where you're using different types of training, but also working with that other professionals, like Andrew was saying about how that you're working together to monitor their load. Like, for example, in other sports, we'll be working with, say, for example, a football coach, a rugby coach, looking at how we're then like monitoring their fatigue through their week to, you know, peak for a weekend. Whereas, you know, individual sports, you're really going for that one, you know, the kind of the fight that's going to kind of make and break what you're going to do moving forward. So I think that's the really nice thing about strength and conditioning in general, that you can be working in lots of different areas, and sort of we're looking for that physical development.
I guess when you go back to the early days, it was kind of almost just you and your dad, wasn't it?
It was. Anyone who knows what my old fella looks like, you know, we'll look at him and think he's not really a picture of health, but he's always had an idea of basic keeping strong and bits of fitness. He's done bits of powerlifting and stuff like that. As time goes on, things change, research changes. Well, me and Andrew was only talking about that this morning, that, you know, science sometimes changes as well. But that's why I like echoing what he says. Communication works well together, and that's why I like to ask Andrew and have Andrew's opinion about certain subjects, because science normally is...
What were you asking about?
Well, just, I mean, I don't want to disclose too much information, give like camp secrets, but, you know, there's the stuff that I ask him about, it's backed up by science, and you can't really argue with that, rather than, you know, you've just heard someone in the local boozer that you need to train like this, because I used to do it back in the day. So, yeah, I think back in the early stages, my old man's emphasis on training was for a boxer, you need to train hard, you need to train fast. If you train slow, you're going to fight slow. If you train fast, you're going to fight faster. So, again, being an explosive fighter, then that's me. So everything you do is in fast bursts. But then as we go onto longer durations and 12 round fights, and knowing when to go up and going down, and, you know, all these different things what comes with experience, that's when you've got to learn about having a little burst here, but and then recovering quickly. And that's where the science part of it really needs to come into play. And that's when I think a meal man would be not scared to admit that he didn't know around that subject. So he would ask out advice, he would ask help. And that's when we started, you know, getting involved with more people who know about that stuff.
So what does the science tell you across a 12-round fight?
I think really what the science tells you above what historically was the case, like Josh said, you know, the old school training methods, just train really hard, we'll smash you, almost that military style. That gives you a really good foundation, makes athletes, you know, quite robust if they don't get injured. Like you said, you've seen these really hard circuits they do. It gives them that tolerance. I think what perhaps historically was missing was then refining that as you're getting closer to fights, understanding how the body adapts and changes, and being able to tailor that so you can get their maximum strength, maximum power, maximum speed up at the time of the competition. That is a science, because we're constantly monitoring them. We look at the test results. We can do some jump tests, we can do some strength tests, you can look at their power and speed, and you can see how that changes over time, depending on how much volume of training we give them, the type of exercises we give them. So we can plan that quite specifically to ensure that they're reaching those max levels when they get to their fight. And that's something that, you know, without the scientific element, you wouldn't really be able to do.
You have so many athletes coming through here. I know a lot of the rugby league teams, little squads come here and do a lot of testing. You've obviously got a lot of athletes, Josh, like the elite athletes. Are you learning from each one? Is the university building up this huge data profile of research?
What we have done really well was part of my role as the course leader of SNC. Here at Leeds Beckett, we link with all of these different providers, which then we can give them the opportunity to have some of our students working alongside these groups of individuals, and also helping them develop into kind of moving them on into the next step. That's been really good for us to help our students move into kind of areas, getting that kind of first foot through the door.
I'm guessing you like the idea of, you know, being a bit of a study.
Yeah, I guess so. Andrew mentioned it a little bit earlier. I think that's where we work really well. He's not coming to the team and said, right, the science says that you shouldn't do that, so don't do that. You know, he's come and he's listened, he's watched us, and he's adapted. You know, and that's what needs to be. I'm not going to sit in and talk bad about anybody, but I know throughout the business, there's S&C coaches who've come in and they've kind of taken over the full team. So they've monitored like sparring days and this and other, and well, you're going to train this day, you're going to do this, you're going to do that. You know, this is what the science says, blah, blah. And then the fighter's gone to ring. 2-3 rounds, they've no engine. You know, not normally, because they haven't prepared how they normally train. Whereas, like Andrew said earlier, we've worked well together. And what worked in the last camp, right, let's look at the data there. That works really well. That went too great, so we'll take that out. I think that pays dividends when you're just that bit of communication between each other.
One of the key things really working with athletes is that understanding that they are an individual and they will, due to their experiences, due to their genetic makeup, they're going to adapt differently to training compared to one other athlete. So if you give those two athletes exactly the same thing, you'll probably get two different results. So sometimes it's, you know, young coaches might come into the profession with what they've learned and they've standardly been given and think, oh, I can just apply this set template and it's going to work the same with everyone. You know, the real world's quite messy. All athletes are different. Their training camps are different. Their coaches are different. So you have to be quite good at being able to adapt that training plan, that planning, that structure to work with that athlete. And that it's a constant refinement. Anyone who says they know the ultimate answer is probably lying. You know, you've got to constantly look at the data, look at the feedback, and then constantly error correct. So, you're refining that approach. And I think that's the most important thing, really.
How important is getting into the students, the bit that Josh said there, that the listening and the watching, as much as the data and the science, the things that you think you know, the listening and the watching?
Yeah, it's so important. It's interesting as well, because like Andrew was saying about, you know, we get the template. So that template has evolved over the last few years. I mean, like if we roll back maybe 15 years, we might have only had, say, 20 studies on plyometrics. And I teach the students now there's over like 2,000 studies. So we can really understand how to manipulate a session to improve power, like with what Josh is wanting to do. Same as with we do like strength training. There's several thousand studies and just certain areas where that wasn't there before. So we've got a good template, but part of the student's journey is to work that actually Josh will have his own unique genetic makeup, which makes him like one of the best in the world. So it's about then tapping into the training that's going to utilize that through testing and feedback and working with him. So that's a journey that all of our students have to go on. And it takes time to make a good athlete, but it also takes time to make a good coach. So we have to kind of help them on that journey.
There was a myth back in the day that you didn't punch that hard. You had a great engine, but you didn't punch it. When you beat Carl Frampton, one of the things he said post-fight is, dispel that myth, he hits hard.
Yeah.
Is that something that you have worked on, the strength of that individual punch?
Yeah, definitely. I feel that were maybe part of the motivation to want to get stronger as well. I mean, when I look back at over the years, when I boxed for my first title, I was 21, fighting a 30-year-old. And it was man versus boy. I mean, I've still got pictures back at home of us on the scales, and he's stacked and he's like, looks really aggressive, and I look like innocent. But, you know, I did more than held me on in terms of physicalness and fitness and desire and boxing. But there were stages where he had the upper hand, and that was that physical strength. And maybe at the time, I probably were fighting at the wrong weight. I probably were fighting a weight or maybe two weights above. And a lot of people had said, you know, to me, old man especially, Josh is not a featherweight, he's a bantamweight. He could do bantam, at least super bantam, but I think you could get him down to bantam. And my old man would always turn around and say, he's not, he's a featherweight. And we're talking like 4 pounds, so to the average person, that's like, no, I can swear that out in Bath, but for elite athletes who were at the very top, he's quite a bit, he's coming down from maybe half a stone difference. So, over the years, I felt that I was lacking something. But Bjorn wanted to always, he always used to say to me, when you get to that level where you're knocking on the door of Europeans and world level, this is where fighters, you see, go to 8, 9, meaning the rounds, and that's when they start dipping. He said, I want you to be able to go up. So when you get to round 7, round 8, round 9, and you come back to corner, I want to say to you, right, go up a gear. And if you're struggling there, then you're not going to be able to do it. But I used to say, well, Dad, these fellas are big. You know, some of these, I remember fighting Martin Lindsay and I'd watch videos of him eating people and with left hooks, and they're spinning around and they were asleep before they hit the deck. And I'm thinking, this is a real strong man. I want to be able to match him in some way. I've always like been a fit fighter and had speed, but like you say, the critics would say, oh, I just really can't punch and to go to that next level. So that's when around the time as well when we started to bring SNC in there. And the sport of boxing is a funny one because, you know, people just think you're moving around and you just hit him. The armchair expert will say, just knock him out.
If only.
Yeah, exactly. But there's so much what comes into it, you know, like speed, agility and movement and coordination and timing. You know, little game plans of like when to go up and when to go down, when you take a little bit out of your man, and then, you know, you can have another few rounds off, but then go up a little bit later. So I think that's where, like I say, when going back, that's when we really started to, you know, to sit down onto punches. And I started to bring that into the table when I needed to at the world level. And I certainly believe that maybe if I knew what I knew now, I might be knocking them all out back when I first won my first title. But it's all about learning and developing.
Without giving the game plan away ahead of the Lee Wood fight, when you're asked to work on something specific, maybe a specific shot, how do you do that? You know, what are you zoning in on as the strength and conditioning coach?
Yeah, sure. I think it's an interesting concept. You could easily just focus on, like you're saying, with punch power. You could easily just focus on that and do all the training focused around that. So we'd say, oh, well, how does he want to throw that knockout punch? These are the muscles we need to really strengthen. And then we do some strength training on that. Okay, now we need to make him really powerful. Now we need to make him really quick. Sure, you could do that. And like Josh said, there's technique where he could just sit down on a punch and do it. But how much are you taking away from the rest of what they do as a fighter? So it's that important balance. And, you know, Josh, a two-time world champion, fighting the way that he's fought and come through. So you do have to kind of be mindful of, you don't want to over-focus on trying to develop one area. Having said that, of course, we want to improve all different aspects. So, you know, through the years, there's been times when can we be able to come out or come in a bit quicker, things like that. So there's, again, specific things we can break down and look at and say, we need to improve his strength through his calves first so that they're going to be strong and robust enough. So then we can do some high impact power training that's going to increase the power in him. And then we do that specifically into, well, what's the actual movement that he's wanting to work on, and then that goes into, you know, the work he's doing in training and sparring and pad work. So you've gone through those steps of in improving the fundamental physical attributes and then the very specific movements and power that we want, and then specifically in the actual training what we get. So that's kind of what you can do. But as I say, you do want to make sure that you don't take away from all the other aspects of the training as well.
I was just going to say there, I was going to add to what Andrew was saying there and come down to a bit of communication for over the years. I think when in other sports, and even some individual sports, like even tennis or, you know, being on the track, them competitions come thick and fast. In the boxing, you could be sat around waiting for the fight. Politics of boxing, you know, it's a business at the same time. You could be waiting maybe 10, 12 months, a year. And when you're training, that's all well and good, but being under the lights for real, that's when it matters. For 36 minutes, that's when you really need to peak. And that, you know, sometimes over that aspects can come into play. You're a year older, it could be a certain time of year, so there's illnesses going around and you might be going in there with lingering illness and stuff. So you don't always get like that next month to you go for that, or like I say, it could be another year. And some other things as well, which I was on about it probably last week, the feedback off each when I give the feedback to Andrew, and I'm always open and honest with how I felt and what I think went right. Things like when I'm doing my S&C, and there's been camps where I've done a lot of it, and there's been camps where I haven't done too much of it, and there's been camps where we've had specific for a certain fight and game plans where I've got to be a bit more robust and in and out of my feet, and there's other times where I've been wanting to be a shell. Now, I've asked Andrew, and I don't think there is so much data about it, but like, boxing's a physical sport. You know, you go in there, you take blows and things, and maybe the data will never be there. But I've always wondered about how punches and trauma to the musculoskeleton can have effects, and how could you prepare for that? I mean, you're never going to be able to really prepare for taking a punch. No one wants to get punched, and I don't think no one's going to let you stand and hit them for data purposes. But on the feedback, I personally know, and I, like I say, I write things down in my diary. For many years, I've had diaries for my camps. I've written down feedback of what I think, and after fights as well. And I always feel that when I've done my bits and bats of S&C, as well as everything else, but when bits and bats of S&C, that when I've got that solid strength and that shell, that muscular shell, that inside, taking punches on the arms and things like that, I feel a lot more robust compared to when I haven't done it.
Is that something specific you're working on?
That's definitely a part of it. And I think that's a really good point Josh brings up, that sometimes there might never be perfect data in one area, because I'm sure you'd agree there'd never be a research study that's going to be approved where we can just hit someone to see how their muscles respond. It's just not going to happen. But you can use the underlying principles of science to make a rationale for, well, if he gets used to taking these shots and we get him stronger and he's got more musculature there, then that probably is going to protect him. We get the feedback from Josh, and Josh says, yep, I feel a lot stronger psychologically. I feel a lot better. Then that gives us that evidence we need to continue putting it in his program.
It's an interesting one, because, you know, it is a learning process. You know, it is evolving. But there isn't data for everything. You know, getting hit in the chops is probably not a great idea. And you might, but that, you know, that is part of the process, isn't it? That there are things you can't get the data on.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's why it's an exciting area to work in, because you can't get that perfect like study to tell you the answer. Sometimes you have to kind of learn it through what the experience is. We do know strength training is really important for absorbing shocks. The stronger you are, the better you can absorb it. And I think that's about where we are with it.
It's quite interesting. Your face lit up when you talked about how exciting a field it is. I mean, it is something that's changing. Are you finding it exciting being in the middle of it?
Yeah. Even though, like I was saying, we know a lot more, there's still a lot more for us to learn. I think we've sort of really bought into exploring how we develop physical performance, and that's all holistically, from your aerobic, anaerobic fitness to, you know, speed, agility, change of direction. Yet we're still finding better ways to train, and then that can then, from a research perspective, that can then drip into practice, which then you can then make better practitioners, and then they'll tell us different ways to make that kind of sprint training or jump training more interesting, and we'll start exploring it all again. So it's quite a nice cyclical process.
One of the things that is fairly unique about boxing is you've got to make weight. The amateur always is told muscle weighs more than fat. You've got to make a weight. How do you balance that part of the conditioning? You know, you could build up a bigger muscular shell, but you're going to weigh more. You're not going to hit that weight.
Yeah, that's a point. That is a fair point. I mean, again, we was only talking about that this morning, and there's been moments when phone's gone. Josh, you might be out in 5 weeks. Right, okay, what's your weight? So all team will get together, we'll laze amongst each other. And then I'm lucky enough that my wife has got a bit of a knowledge in food and in that aspect. So, no, it's always a bit tough. But like I say, it's a bit backwards, really, because you're putting your body through well constantly, and sometimes you're not giving yourself the calories. I mean, you look at someone like a cyclist, puts her body into crazy, crazy states, and heart rates go through the roof, and they're consuming 3,000-5,000 calories, you know, for that. But we've got to do opposite. The duration is not as long, but taking trauma to the body, and it's, you know, one-to-one combat, it takes its toll physically. But again, you've got to make that weight, you've got to make that penalty, and to be able to go into sessions day in, day out, but then also repair. It's a real fine balance, but it's just bits and bats what we have learned over the years. Again, working with Andrew because Andrew records bits and bats like body fat percentages, and we know from me standing on my scales at home to coming into here and then reading the body fat percentage, how much weight could potentially take off without affecting. And so then that I'll give that feedback back to, you know, Natasha at home, and then she can cater for food around there. So it's all a bit of a team aspect. And for instance, if I've got a sparring session, I know that it's going to burn so much. I know that I can eat this beforehand, but then if I've got a steady day, you know, then the meals will be a bit lighter. I've got a bit of a sweet tooth, so they'll say bye-bye to cheesecakes and things like that. But again, with, you know, I'll come back to here on a Friday, and, you know, Andrew, after the sessions, will analyse how strong I've been. And if everything's still up there, but the weight's coming down, then it's... We know we're in a very, very good place, and this all only comes from being up here in the science.
How difficult a balancing act is it?
It's definitely an extra consideration in something like boxing, where you have to worry about that weight limit. I just said, in some other sports where you can kind of just eat loads of calories to make sure they're fueled for the training and performance, it's, you know, you don't need to worry about that too much. But boxing is a bit more of a challenge with that. Josh is one of the better ones, I'd say. He's not like some of the ones you might see who, you know, balloon up after a fight and it's a real struggle. Josh is very professional. He stays in pretty good condition, other than maybe last year. A few too much ice cream, but generally he stays pretty good. You know, his lifestyle's always been good. He doesn't really drink. He, you know, eats pretty healthily anyway. So obviously there is that weight cut that we have, but it's not too extreme. But we've definitely, you know, found a good method of analysing that. Like Josh says, we do record his body fat percentage every week, so we'll have a good idea where he's at, how far out he is from the fights. We know what his weight is now. We know his body fat percentage, so we know how much, we kind of know what from previous fights, what body fat percentage he needs to be fight week. So we know how far out from that. So we can see what amount of weight he needs to lose by then. And you can kind of then hopefully plan that, so he's doing it a little bit incrementally each week, rather than just getting right to the last week and then starving himself and you know, not doing it, because obviously that's not ideal either. So we've got that quite good balance, I think. And probably the other factor that you mentioned before was how getting them stronger could give them more muscle, which makes them weigh more, which is a factor as well. But that's something that, you know, we've learned pretty well through strength and conditioning science over the past, you know, 20, 30 years, is that depending on the type of training that you do in terms of sets and reps and intensities, you can increase strength quite a lot without putting on too much of the muscle mass, which is obviously what is quite important for us.
And Alex, though boxing is very specific, you have to make a certain weight on a certain day and there are checkpoints all the way through, most athletes do have an optimum weight, don't they? Whatever their sport, to be able to move the fastest or whatever. And is that part of the whole process of finding for each individual where the best place is?
I think what we do know is about physical characteristics. So we know in sport now, what is it kind of key physical training, but then also testing that we can do to make sure we're maintaining or improving performance. Strength's just one of them, and strength to weight ratio for most sports is probably the most important thing, knowing that someone's getting stronger, but then keeping a similar weight or going up. Like power to weight ratio, again, in boxing, that's really important. So developing those profiles, but then testing. So that's another kind of key things that you guys have been talking about testing and monitoring, knowing that as you're improving those test scores, that's going to help them in their actual performance of their sport.
I don't wish to bring up your age. You are considerably younger than me, but you are towards the back end of your career. Is there a key thing that you wish you'd told your younger self about the whole strength and conditioning process?
You say that about the age, and I was wondering about this where one of the fellas in my gym over there, my old man's like, talked about me being in my peak in my late 20s, but I don't think I was, and I feel like I potentially might be hitting it now, and that's 35, and maybe 10 years, maybe 20 years ago, people have said, that's quite old for a boxer, that, you know, especially for a smaller weight, your heavyweights can go considerably longer. But things have changed over the years, and data's constantly changing, and studies are coming out. And like Andrew said, in between fights, I keep well, I keep in good shape, I don't drink and things like that. So these all have an effect on a person when they're going into the next phase of training or whatever, or getting ready for the next competition. And I think just keeping that base, I've always known that. If anything, what I would tell my younger self is just know the importance of rest and stretching, staying loose, because I think from a long time, and maybe that's just been my mindset, always wanting to be better, always wanting to improve. There's some days where no matter what, I've just done whatever I wanted to do, and they've gone against me. Sometimes my old man's instruction of just relax, just take a day off, and certainly stretching, because I think when you're a younger athlete, you can get away with being a bit loose, but before you know it, you're getting out of bed and my back's a bit sore.
Wait till you get to my age, young man.
Or you're picking up your kids at home and that's a bit sore. So yeah, I think just that recovery process. But I'd like to think that I've got to learn about it just in the right time. So I do know the importance, these days of taking an evening to have a really good stretch out and loosen up. But yeah.
Music to your ears, isn't it?
Yeah, again, Josh is, he is a professional, and he always has been, really, throughout his career. Even if he didn't do some of the SSC stuff we do now, early in his career, he was still training, he was still eating well and doing all the good stuff. So, and that plays a big factor into the age thing. I think sometimes people just see the number on the paper and assume that 35's old. But it really does vary. You look at some really high top level athletes now in the world. Cristiano Ronaldo is over 40 now. Roger Federer played till over 40. LeBron James still playing the NBA over 40. Some people get to that age and they are totally beat up because they've maybe not lived the best lifestyle or enjoyed themselves too much, haven't committed as well to the training. But the people who are really professional, who've not drank much alcohol maybe, who've eaten well, who've trained hard their whole career, they can be 35 like Josh and he's still improving. We're still seeing improvements in his physical attributes. So where people think, 35, he must be well on the decline, it's going to be done. Physically, he's stronger than he's ever been, more powerful than ever been, quicker than he's ever been. I think because of how he's approached it and how he's developed, we're not seeing those drop-offs. I think inevitably you will, like you're saying, in recovery, probably becomes a little bit harder. As you start to get to late 30s, 40s, reaction time maybe starts to drop a little bit. If you look after yourself, I think these days as an athlete, you can push to 40.
Is that one of the exciting things, that you are actually, the research, the work that you're doing, you are lengthening careers?
We do know at points that we'll have neuromuscular decline, but that actually happens a bit later than what we often think about. It's late 30s, so getting the right team, getting the right training, then we can be really lengthening those careers really well. Developing those kind of strength will keep that strength going as well. We know that the strength decline is very slow, so certain types of training can help boost that through, which means that people can still carry on getting stronger.
Just a final one to you, Alex, that we are talking about an elite athlete who is in camp for a fight. But for all of us, strength and conditioning is important, isn't there? And there's much more knowledge about just what the average human, particularly in my age, should be doing. This isn't just something for an elite athlete.
Yeah, that's right. In the broad sense of health and training, we've really unpicked the importance of a holistic training, knowing that getting stronger now, there's lots of research showing that has incredible health benefits for mortality. We didn't really know that before, but strength training is really important for that. And then the same as cardiovascular fitness is another kind of important things. And then also when you think about, I'd like to move around a bit more when I get to my later decades. So actually strength training really helps that because it helps keep you mobile. And there's been some brilliant research with people in the elderly about how much greater quality of life that you have. So it's not super straight into the world of strength and conditioning, but that broader world of kind of physical fitness is actually kind of really important for everybody, I think.
Josh, we wish you the very, very best
Thank
of luck
much,
in there
yeah.
and good luck with being in camp. If you want to know more about what Andrew and Alex get up to here at the university, check out the show notes. Do follow, and subscribe to the podcast. We will see you next time. Goodbye for now.